Welcome to Chewing the Yat, WAMF, 90.3 FM, New Orleans. We're on every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Chewing the Yat, we talk to some of New Orleans' most interesting people. And today we certainly have one of those in Mr. Bruce Spicer, who is a world-renowned expert on the Beatles and a native New Orleanian. And to prove that he's an expert, he's written several books. So we're here to talk about his latest book. So welcome, Bruce.
Glad to be here. It's always fun sitting around chewing the yat with you, you know?
Well, I found our other encounters pretty enjoyable, yes. So I hope this one's just like that. Well, your new book is Beatles for Sale to Help, which is two Beatles albums. I told you before we started the recording here that if I make any mistakes in facts, I'm sure you'll straighten me out. But from the little research that I did, the Beatles for Sale album and To Help, they were the fourth and fifth studio albums that the Beatles made. Is that correct?
That's correct. And for the listeners out there, when we're talking about it, we're talking about how the records were released in Great Britain. In the U.S., it wasn't quite that simple, but these were those albums released in the U.K. And in the U.S., Capitol Records got two albums out of Beatles for Sale. The first one was called Beatles 65. It could have been jokingly called Beatles for Sale Part 1. It had several of the tracks from Beatles for Sale, actually the first six songs from side one of Beatles for Sale, and then also two Carl Perkins cover songs from that particular album, plus their current single, I Feel Fine, She's a Woman, and then a song left over in their Beatles inventory from A Hard Day's Night era called I'll Be Back. So it was an 11-track album, and in the U.S. we loved it because it not only had those great new album tracks, but it had the single songs on it as well, which we had heard on the radio. And we kind of liked the convenience of having the singles on the albums. In the U.K., their manager, Brian Epstein, and their producer, George Martin, thought that it wasn't really fair to put singles on albums because it would be making the kids buy the same two songs twice. We liked having the convenience.
Sure. Well, and before we get too much further in today's interview, The Beatles for Sale to Help, which is the name of the new book, which came out in August of 2025, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a series of books that you've done. So this is like your ninth, is this your ninth book about the albums?
Yes, it's the ninth and final book in the album as far as dates of publication. But as far as chronological order of the albums, this one would appear to actually be the third book in the series. So it's both the ninth and the third at the same time.
Okay. All right. Fair
and,
enough.
And going with more confusion, so Capitol Records in the summer of 1965, Beatles for Sale and Beatles 65 both came out in, you know, toward the end of the year in 1964. Capitol called it Beatles 65 because originally they thought it would come out in January, but they rush released it to get those Christmas sales, and it came out in mid-December 64, called Beatles 65, which is okay. But they came out with their next album called Beatles 6, and that contained the songs from Beatles for Sale that had yet to be released in the United States, plus a couple of tracks that the Beatles had recorded for the Help album, and plus two songs specifically recorded for the Capitol album to get them up to the required 11 tracks, and those would be two Larry Williams rockers called Dizzy Miss Lizzy and Bad Boy. And the thing about Larry Williams, he truly was a bad boy, got himself in a lot of trouble and broke a bunch of laws, but he was a very talented songwriter and singer, and he was from the New Orleans area.
Oh, go figure.
Yeah, imagine a bad boy from New Orleans.
Yeah.
And he actually, the Beatles loved him so much, they actually recorded three songs written by him. Another one, Slow Down, was released on an EP in the UK. So, and on an album in the US, Something New. So they really admired Larry Williams, and they also did his songs, you know, Short Fat Fanny would have been in their sets back in the day as well.
Well, you know, I noticed when doing a little research about these two albums before I came to talk to you that in this era, 64, 65, before that, I mean, the Beatles were obviously influenced by American rock and roll a lot. And
yes.
They admired a lot of those people, and they did some covers of those things like Little Richard and things like that.
Yes.
But also in that time, they actually met Dylan.
Uh-huh.
And that gave them a little bit and then when they were in the United States on their tours, they listened to a lot of country music.
Yes.
So their music changed a little bit from that time.
That'd be fair to say. As far as the country music, Ringo was a really big country fan, and John and Paul as well. Not so much what you think of as this pure country, but if you think of, if you view the Everly Brothers as country, and they certainly were, the Beatles' harmonies are right out of the Everly Brothers. When you listen to their harmonies, it's exactly what you hear on recordings by the Everly Brothers. So that was a big influence, of course, as was Buddy Holly, who would be certainly country-influenced in rock and roll as well. That was certainly a part of it. And also Bob Dylan. The album Beatles 65 and Beatles for Sale opens up with songs that are showing a maturing of their songwriting. It opens up with No Reply that musically sounds upbeat and goes into a kind of a Latin-flavored middle eight, but lyrically is a pretty sad song. And it was a song that John was very proud of because Dick James, who was a very famous musical publisher who was publishing the Beatles catalog, Dick James told John, this is the first time you've written a song that really is a story that resolves itself. And that was, you know, John took as a compliment. And then the next song on it was a song called I'm a Loser, which was very much Dylan influenced because you had, you know, acoustic guitar and harmonica in it. And the Beatles had used harmonica before, but not quite the same way. And it was more of a Dylan-style harmonica as opposed to, you know, a John Lennon-style harmonica. And for a rock and roll person to be able to sing I'm a Loser, that was pretty out there for the time. I mean, certainly in country, nothing wrong with that. People admit they're losers. But in rock and roll, no, you know, you don't admit that. And it was very introspective, too. And John had the line, you know, but I'm not what I appear to be, which was a very Dylan-esque type line. So definitely moving in that direction. And then the third song on the album, Babies in Black, which was a bit of a downer. And it also, though, was in kind of a, you know, a waltz tempo, kind of 6-8 time. And that was kind of unique. And then after that, they get into good old rock and roll with Rock and Roll Music by Chuck Berry, you know, and have, of course, you know, I'll Follow the Sun, a beautiful ballad that Paul had shaken the cobwebs off of. He had written it many years earlier, and the Beatles really hadn't performed it because it was kind of a soft type song. And, you know, they were rock and rollers. They didn't want to do that type of song. But as they were maturing, sure, we can do a song like that.
You know, it's interesting to listen to that part because as an artist, if I can call myself an artist, I will sometimes look back at things that I did, say, 10 years ago in a poem or comedy sketch, and I didn't use it. And I look back at it, and it's better than I thought, and I can use it. Now, he probably wanted to use it probably originally, but maybe he didn't get in for one reason or another.
Yeah, it might have been a case of John saying, look, you know, Paul, that's really not our image. And so they did a little bit more work on the song, and it became quite a, you know, an excellent song. A lot of people really, I'll Follow the Sun is, you know, their favorite or one of their top songs, you know, on that album.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, about the Beatles, and we'll get into Help in those other tracks in a bit, but was that by this time, the Beatles had become much more comfortable in the studio. Their first two albums, for the most part, were recorded on two-track recorders, but for A Hard Day's Night, they were using a four-track recorder. Now, today, you know, people might say, well, you know, I remember as a kid, you know, they had 8 tracks and 16-track studios and 32 and 64 tracks. With digital, we have unlimited tracks, as many as you want. But this was a big deal. And what it meant was they could do more as far as overdubs and instruments. And what they did for their first albums, they would record live in the studio. They would be playing and singing at the same time, and George might even play his guitar solo live. And they might do some overdubs. They might overdub a harmonica part or some extra percussion. And by the time, you know, they moved on, and that was kind of what they were doing on A Hard Day's Night. And then when they went to the album Beatles for Sale, they still were pretty much using that technique. Where the big change comes in their recording technique is for the Help album. And for that, what they would do is get a basic backing track first. They might sing a guide vocal off mic, or they might do a guide vocal on the first take or two. But basically, the objective was to get a good, solid musical track first, and then they would do overdubs on that. So maybe George would come back and say, okay, well, I want to overdub my guitar solo. or on the song Help, it had some tricky guitar parts, so he might not play those. You know, they would just get the backing track, and then he would overdub that. They would overdub the vocals. They would also use something at this time called artificial double tracking. And what that involved was that typically John might sing a song live and Paul might sing a harmony part live, or they might do it as their first overdubs, but then they would go back in and they would sing it again. And the idea was it had a fuller sound if you had, you know, two of John's voices and two of Paul's voices, or the same with George. And so they would do this overdubbing. And John was kind of on the lazy side, and he didn't really want to keep going back in the studio to overdub. So for their later records, well, by the time we get to Revolver, they would use a technique called artificial double tracking, where they would take that vocal track and run it slightly out of sync and play it again as a second track. Now, that came later on, but for this album, they were still double tracking, and occasionally on some of the songs, if you listen carefully, John would mess up his double tracking a little bit. And sometimes the mess-up worked well because he'd be singing something slightly out of sync and maybe a slightly different word, but it kind of made it more effective, oddly enough. So, you know, that was big changes in how they were approaching songs in the studio.
Sure. Well, with Bruce Spizer here, who's the expert on the Beatles, and you can tell that he has gone into this in depth. And how can people get your books? I want to make sure that gives you a website.
We don't want to forget that.
No.
And the website's very easy. It's just Beatle, BEATLE.net, N-E-T. No S in it, just Beatle.net. And the books are available through the website. And I do encourage you all to come to it. We have the entire Beatles album series. A lot of my earlier titles have sold out, though, and go for pretty good money in the secondary market. So I encourage people to purchase the books before they're gone and more expensive in that secondary market.
Well, I hope Warren Buffett's listening.
Yes, so indeed.
So you can buy some. And if you get a chance to see Bruce do a presentation live of one of the books, he does a wonderful job. You'll never see a better book presentation than by Bruce Spizer with a lot of slides and videos and a lot of expertise. Now, one thing I wanted to talk about just briefly, I talked about how Dylan, gave the Beatles some ideas to go a different direction, but they also gave him the same, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the interesting thing about it, too. Dylan, when he first heard I Want to Hold Your Hand, was extremely impressed with the song. And part of the reason he was impressed with it was he thought on the bridge where the Beatles are singing, you know, that, and when I touch you, bridge, and they're singing, it's such a feeling, I can't hide, I can't hide. Dylan thought they were singing, it's such a feeling, I get high, I get high. And Dylan thought that was pretty cool.
Because he was probably high at the time.
Well, very well may have been. He was, you know, he certainly did introduce him to marijuana at his hotel room when they were touring the States in 64. And the interesting thing, too, was that Dylan got more interested in, you know, this rock and roll music. He was a folk purist, and to the horror of the folk purists, here is Dylan, you know, by the time we get to 65, picking up an electric guitar, at Newport and all the other things, and the songs like a Rolling Stone, I mean, Highway 61 Revisited, another side of Bob Dylan had acoustic and electric, and it truly was another side of Dylan, heavily influenced by the Beatles. So as you say, it was a mutual influence and admiration society.
Again, the new book is Beatles for Sale, to Help, about two albums, Beatles for Sale and Help. We have plenty of time today, aren't you, Nayat, thankfully, so we can get to Help in a little bit, but let's explore something else I wanted to ask you. I know you talk about it in the book. What was the main difference between when they would release the music in England, mm-hmm. the United States, and, say, Canada? What was the reasoning behind how they would go about that?
All right, well, first of all, let's go back to the dark ages in the 1960s. We were not in a global community back then. And each market, each country, essentially released records by artists as they deemed fit for their market. So it was never anything of, oh, I can't believe they're taking these carefully constructed Beatle albums and messing with them. That was standard procedure throughout the world. The records would be different in Canada, Germany, Japan, England. I mean, that was just the way it was. And so that was part of it. There was nothing unusual about that. And it wasn't just the Beatles. I mean, if you look at albums by the Hollies, the Kinks, the Rolling Stones, the Dave Clark Five, all these groups or albums are different in the first part of the 60s in both the U.S. and throughout the world. And even people within the groups might recognize it. For example, with the Rolling Stones, their manager, Andrew Lug Oldham, recognized this, and he was the one making the decisions. In the U.K., they released a Willie Dixon song, Little Red Rooster, that was a number one hit in the U.K., yet it was never released as a single in the U.S., because he knew if it made the top 20, it would be a miracle. And, you know, so there were just differences like that between the markets. No one thought anything of it. Another difference was that in the U.K., royalties on albums were computed differently. In other words, you have to pay like a royalty to the songwriters. And in the U.K., you would take an album, and for an album, there would be a set dollar or pound amount, I guess, would say, sure, royalty paid. And once you had that set amount for the album, you divide it by the number of songs on it, and each publisher would get its pro rata share. In the U.S., it wasn't done that way. You pay what was called a mechanical license for each song. So in the U.K., they typically had 14 songs. In the U.S., we typically had 11 or 12. And the reason we had less was we could save money on the mechanical licenses. And someone might say, well, the difference between 14 and 11, Bruce, if I'm doing my math right, is only 6 cents. Boy, capital is really stingy. All right, but let's think about what 6 cents means if you've got sales of a million albums. Now you've got $60,000. Oh, that's not a lot of money. Well, back if you adjust it for inflation, that's well over a quarter of a million, nearly $300,000. So yes, it made a big difference. Capitol typically, on their album Meet the Beatles, had 12 songs. And after that, most of the albums had 11 songs because they could save that extra 2 cents.
Okay, well, that's solves some problem there as far as why it was different. I mean, I figured it was because of audience taste, for one thing. I mean, they would decide what they thought would sell.
Yes. Teenagers feel they were paying twice for the same music, so most of the Beatle albums do not have singles on them. There are some exceptions, of course. Whereas in the U.S., that wasn't the case, and Capitol felt that hit singles make hit albums. When you look at album sales pre-Beatles for a teenage album, 250,000 units was remarkable. Really, nobody ever topped that. Elvis's rock and roll albums didn't do that. The Beach Boys didn't do that. But the Beatles, by having that hit single, I Want to Hold Your Hand, back with I Saw Her Standing There on the album Meet the Beatles, in a little over 2 months' time, Meet the Beatles had sold 3.6 million copies. Think about that. Capitol had projected sales, if things go well with the Beatles, we'll sell a quarter of a million. And they sold 3.6 million
wow.
in about a little over 2 months. So Capitol's philosophy of hit singles make hit albums certainly worked.
That 6 cents is adding up now.
Oh, yeah. As it absolutely is. So you get the idea of why things were done differently. And also covers were different. Capitol did keep the similar album cover for the UK equivalent with the Beatles, but they called the album Meet the Beatles, and they had Meet the Beatles in big, large letters at the top. You look at Beatles for Sale, and if you look at that, in the upper left-hand corner, you've got the Parlophone and EMI logos, and then in micro print, Beatles for Sale. You can barely read it. Whereas Dave Dexter of Capitol felt people, when they're flipping through albums in record bins, that, what they see at the top is important. So he had in big block letters, Beatles 65. You couldn't miss it, And so the covers were done differently for that reason, and Capitol wanted bright colors to track your attention, not drab colors like Beatles for Sale, which would be artsy, but not necessarily an attention grabber.
Right.
So, and the person who was making these decisions at Capitol was a guy named Dave Dexter. Dave Dexter turned down the Beatles 4 times before he was kind of forced to say, okay, we're going to put out the Beatles records in America. But he was head of A&R, Artist and Repertoire for Foreign Product. And even though he had turned down the group all those times, the president of Capitol, Alan Livingston, still allowed Dexter to program these albums. And he did a remarkable job of it. Once you get past the idea of, hey, this isn't what the Beatles wanted, if you look at those early albums, Meet the Beatles, the perfect album to introduce the Beatles to America. The Beatles' second album, one of the greatest rock and roll albums of all time, has great songs on it. You look at Beatles 65, Beatles 6, all these were really wonderful rock and roll albums.
Well, what are some of the songs that were on Beatles for Sale, for people who are not necessarily that familiar with the Beatles as you are?
Right. Well, we talked about initially, that it had on it, No Reply, and I'm a Loser, Babies in Black. But it also had six rock and roll songs on it, cover versions that the Beatles didn't write. It had a total of 14 songs. Eight were Lennon McCartney songs, but six were cover versions. The previous Beatles album, A Hard Day's Night, were all Lennon McCartney songs. So some critics in revisionist history go, well, the Beatles were tired at this point. They were burnt out. Look at the album cover. They look tired. They look drab. And this isn't really a good album. The hell it isn't. It's a fantastic album. Although it had six cover songs on it, these were great cover tunes. Rock and Roll Music by Chuck Berry. You had two Carl Perkins songs, Everybody's Trying, to Be My Baby, Honey Don't. I mean, these were great songs. You also, had Words of Love by Buddy Holly. You had Mr. Moonlight, which is a much maligned song that was an obscure tune by, Dr. Feelgood and the Interns, a B-side, no less. But for me, if you just listen to the opening song with John's incredible opening, that alone to me is worth the price of admission. And then it had Kansas City. There's a lot of confusion about that song. They say, well, it's a medley between, the song Kansas City written by Lieber and Stoller and Little Richard's Hey, 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 Hey. Not really. It's the Little Richard arrangement of Kansas City. And to me, that's one of Paul's greatest Beatle vocals and great call and response vocals. With Paul and John and George on the response. I mean, really great track. So these are the songs from that session, an unfairly maligned album, primarily done with people, who were revisionist people years later who, thought they were such hotsy-totsy rock critics that they could come in and say, well, that's not a good album. It's a step backwards. It's not. It's another step forward.
Well, I mean, you alluded to
the fact. I'm also missing, I forgot to mention, 8 Days a Week, even though John didn't like it. That's a great pop rock song. Great song.
It is. It is. Well, you mentioned that, one thing about them, I mean, they were pretty prolific in general, but at this time they were really kind of on the go like all the time.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is a group that, when were they going to have time to record this album? They come back from a tour of the United States, and EMI says, we need an album for Christmas. And, oh, by the way, write us a new single. So EMI is requesting 16 new songs as soon as you can get them done. And in the meantime, the Beatles are doing a tour of England. So, they're going into the studio on a Sunday and maybe knocking out five songs. Just incredible stuff. And it gets even crazier for Help. But this is what the Beatles were doing back then. So you want to move on to Help now?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I was going to say that you also talk about what's going on in society a lot.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
In your books about, different things that were going on. And that kind of goes into Help to some degree. I mean, Help was their second film after they did A Hard Day's Night. And A Hard Day's Night was pretty much accepted by the critics. I mean, very, loved it.
Critics had no idea what was coming. They were getting ready to tear it apart. And then they saw it and they found themselves laughing throughout. And they made comparisons, both in the UK and the US and even Canada. All the critics were saying, this reminds us of the Marx Brothers.
Right.
It was done black and white in a documentary style of following the Beatles for a day and a half. Day and a half in the life of the Beatles, and they're on a train, they're rehearsing for a show, they give a concert, for a TV show. And, I mean, it was very funny. The writer of the film was from Liverpool, Alan Owen, and he did it in a way of, he traveled with the Beatles first to get an idea of what their sense of humor was like. And when they were on the set, there'd be times where the Beatles would look at the script and then say, we really wouldn't say that. And then say, well, what would you say? And they'd tell them, and it would rewrite it. So there was a lot more of that going on. By the time they got to Help, they were kind of tired with the idea behind it. They were smoking a bunch of pot, and they really didn't change the script that much when it came to Help.
Yeah, well, they also got a lot more money to produce it because the other one was a hit. So they got it was in color.
Yes,
and they went all around the world. They went to the Alps and
the Bahamas.
Yeah.
And it also was very James Bond influenced.
Right,
James Bond was very big at the time. Another British icon, of course. And there are actually multiple scenes in Help that were influenced by Goldfinger. And in one of my presentations, I show those clips. You know, here's a clip from Goldfinger. Here's a clip from Help. And you see the influence, which is kind of a fun type thing.
It is. It is. It is a fun type thing. Well, I mean, how was this album, you know, received in general by not only the critics, but the general public as well?
Well, the Help album was very well received. And one critic in the UK called it the mini moods of the Beatles because it had ballads, it had pop, it had rock and roll, it had country and Western. I mean, it had, you know, it had everything type thing. And the other thing was that the bulk of the songs were recorded in about 5-day period before they left for filming in the Bahamas in February. So they go into the studio, they record a bunch of songs, actually more than would go in the film, but they wanted to give their director, Dick Lester, about a dozen songs for him to choose about seven for the film, seven or eight for the film, which is what he did. He picked seven. And then the other songs, some of them were not really, you know, That Means a Lot and If You've Got Trouble, really weren't good enough for release, and they didn't come out to an anthology many years later. And the others ended up on the second side of Help. So just like the A Hard Day's Night album in the UK, side one was songs from the film. In side two were other songs recorded by the Beatles. And they were recorded for Help at a later time. We talked before that they were using a different technique. They were learning to use the studio more. And you'll hear some exotic percussion instruments on Help that you may not have heard, you know, on earlier Beatle albums and things of that nature. You know, yes, they use cowbell. You know, the old joke of more cowbell. The other thing, too, was that George had two songs on the album. He had I Need You and You Like Me Too Much. So this was like, you know, before George had only had one song on a Beatles album. And all of a sudden, here he has two songs on the Help LP. And also Paul does something that he'd probably been wanting to do for a while, but finally asserts his authority in the studio, and that's he plays lead guitar. Paul plays lead guitar on three tracks on the Help album, and he plays acoustic guitar on two tracks, and that was different. One of those songs, you have George and Paul playing the same solo, but in, you know, different scales. So, you know, it becomes kind of like, you know, different octaves, and it's really strange to hear, but it's very, very effective. So you have that going on. But, you know, on Ticket to Ride, Paul's the one playing the lead guitar breaks and the lead guitar at the end of the song. You know, on Another Girl, Paul's the one who's playing the lead guitar. You know, The Night Before, Paul is playing the lead guitar. Now, these are overdubs. You know, live in the studio to get that basic track, Paul's playing bass, but then when they go to do the overdubs, Paul is on his Epiphone Casino. They have new instruments on Help, I should mention. Paul, George, and John all got Epiphone Casinos. It's a hollow body electric guitar instrument, very good blues guitar. In Paul's guitar playing, if you listen to it on Help, it's very bluesy. And so that's his lead guitar style. He plays an acoustic guitar. He has a Texan, Gibson Texan, I mean an Epiphone Texan, and he uses that on I've Just Seen a Face, and he also uses it on Yesterday. Now, let's talk about one session that Paul had. And I'll start the preface of it where when the album came out, they released a single, and Help was the key single from the album. They had previously released Ticket to Ride, and Yes It Is. Yes It Is wasn't on the album. It was only a B-side, but what a B-side. And for Help, the B-side was a song called I'm Down, which Paul had wanted to write a Little Richard-style rocker that the Beatles could use to close their concerts instead of Little Richard's Long Tall Sally. And when you listen to I'm Down, the strain on his voice, it must have been incredible. And this guy who's reviewing the album says, and the single says, it's amazing, you know, that Paul didn't tear his vocal cords completely to pieces from singing I'm Down. But what the guy did not know, and what many of your listeners may not realize, on one of the sessions for the non-film songs, Paul comes in and he sings I've Just Seen a Face, kind of a country western folk flavored song. And he's the one doing all that fancy guitar work. Some of it's overdubbed. And George is playing a 12-string acoustic guitar. So the first notes you hear are George going, dun, dun. And then all that fancy triplet-type stuff is Paul overdubbed. And then both of them are strumming. So he does that song. And after that, Paul does I'm Down. Wow. You know, think of that. But there's more. After shredding his vocal cords on I'm Down, the Beatles go out to dinner, and he comes back in the studio and does Yesterday. I mean, can you imagine one person doing those three songs, boom, 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 in a studio? And yet, you know, Yesterday's beautiful song, George Martin suggests, you know, the other Beatles, when Paul plays it for them, John and George say, I can't think of anything I'd add to that. Ringo agrees. And so it's just Paul on acoustic guitar, and George Martin says, you know, I think it would be really nice if we overdubbed a string quartet. Paul initially didn't like the idea. Oh, I don't want Muzak. And George Martin says, no, trust me on this. It'll be really tasteful. And he and Paul work out a string quartet arrangement. And now you have the Beatles really expanding, bringing in a string quartet on a song.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear the background of some of these songs that we all, you know, grew up on and have lived with most of our lives, people of my age. So that's one of the good things about your books. Again, tell us how to get the books.
Yeah, the books are available through my website, Beatle.net. They're all available, you know, other sources. But the advantage of ordering through Beatle.net is that all the books that are shipped from my office, they're the ones ordered on the website, I sign. And also, there's a place on the website where you can put in special instructions. So if you want the book, you know, to you or your girlfriend or your boyfriend or whatever, I'm happy to, you know, put a personalization for it, whatever message you want, as long as it's not obscene or offensive.
There you go. Well, I can tell you, by having read the books and seen the books and been able to become a friend of Bruce's, which I'm grateful for, these books are incredible. And if you have anybody in your life that's a Beatles fan, especially, you can't give anybody a better gift than one of these books.
And if we could hold the book up to the microphone here.
Yeah, I will.
You can see it's very colorful.
Yeah.
And the books, each of these books has about 250 images, and the images are either color or original black and white. We're not going to color 10 things that came out in black and white, but the bulk of the images are indeed color images. And the text in the book layout is done in such a way that if you're reading about something, the image pretty much is going to be either on that page or on the next page in a double two-page fold. And a lot of time is spent with my graphic designer, Diana Thornton, and I to get the books to be as attractive as they can be. Diana has been with me, I guess, about 27 years through all 17 books that I did. She's with Crescent Music Services, a terrific graphic designer, and just I can't imagine doing a book without her. And then some of the chapters are written by friends of mine, two people from Beatle Fan magazine, the editor-in-chief Bill King and associate editor Al Sussman. Al writes about what was going on in the world at the time. Another good buddy of mine, Frank Daniels, will write about film, or sometimes Frank writes about, and this Beatles for Sale to Help, he does a chapter on comparing James Bond and the Beatles, and it's many people tell me it's one of their favorite chapters in the book. And then Pierce Hemmingston writes about what was going on in Canada. So the basic format for this and all the books in the series, you have a chapter on what was going on in the UK, historical. In other words, if you were living in the UK, what would you be learning from the music magazines that came out in the UK? They had four different music magazines coming out every week, plus a trade magazine. How were these records reviewed at the time? What did people think of them at the time? So it's contemporaneous, not revisionist, let's go back and rewrite history. I do the same treatment for the U.S. Pierce Hemmingston does the same for Canada. Al writes about what was going on in the world, what was going on in music. I often write about what was going on in film. And we have a middle section of the book, which I've called Fan Recollections, where just everyday people write in and talk about, you know, what these records or films or singles meant to them. And it's amazing how many people experience these records with their parents. You wouldn't have thought that. and some wonderful stories like that. And some of the fan recollections, like in The Hard Day's Night, Patty Boyd writes about how she met George Harrison on the set of A Hard Day's Night and ended up marrying him. So, you know, you get some famous people, not just everyday people. In the Sgt. Pepper book, you know, fan recollections from Pat Tenizio of the Smithereens, Peter Tork of the Monkees, and Billy Joel. So, you know, it's many people tell me the fan recollections are their favorite, you know, part of the books. Mm-hmm. And then the final sections are talk about the album covers, you know, how they were shot, who the photographer was, what was the idea they were trying to capture behind it. And then the final section is on the music itself. And it's a session by, you know, song by song approach for the sessions. It goes through all the songs recorded for the album and its associated singles. And it doesn't do it on they did this day and the next day they did this. It's song by song. And it also talks about how the songs were written, what influenced them. And, you know, as you know, I feel that you get a very thorough run through of the songs, but not done in a way that it's more than you can handle. It's not information overload. You know, first of all, I have page limitations. And secondly, I don't want to give people more information than they can digest. I'm not a music major. I don't know music theory. I know what sounds good. I know what I like. I can describe what I'm hearing. But you're not going to see a lot of fancy terms in there that you can't follow along that you might see in books that are written by, you know, music professors. Wonderful books, but I can't write that way because I'm not a music major.
Well, you do a wonderful job with these books. We're talking with Bruce Spicer, a renowned Beatles expert and Orleanian. Let's get to help now to the movie. A couple of things about the film that I found that was kind of influential. They talk about how it was influential on the classic TV series Batman.
Oh, yes.
And also on it helped to inspire later on, I guess in the 80s, the music videos.
Yes, here's the thing. In A Hard Day's Night, most of the performance of the videos, the Beatles were either rehearsing songs or playing them at the Scala Theater. One of them that is slightly showing in the direction they were going is for I Should Have Known Better. They're in a, you know, in a baggage car on the train, and the Beatles are sitting around playing cards, and all of a sudden, the next thing you know, they're, you know, you've got the song I Should Have Known Better going on, and then all of a sudden, they're playing instruments. So kind of a, you know, kind of surreal type thing. And for this next film, the Beatles specifically did not want to do another Hard Day's Night. And Dick Lester didn't want to do a bunch of Hard Day's Night videos where the Beatles are strictly performing. So you had some of that. You know, you did have two songs they're recording on the Salisbury Plain. You've got them recording You're Going to Lose That Girl in the studio. But then you've got Ticket to Ride, which is, you know, kind of a concept video where the Beatles are shown skiing. The Beatles are shown having a picnic in the snow. The Beatles are shown shoveling coal on a train, you know, and these type of things that you would see particularly in the Monkees, which influenced the Monkees. And then these same type of videos influenced MTV to the point of where Dick Lester, the producer, had been called the father of MTV videos. And of course, his classic response was he demanded a paternity test.
Yeah.
And, you know, and even the music, more Dylan influence, you know, you've got a song like You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, very Dylan-esque type folk ballad. And John had a new instrument that he used on the album. He had a 12-string Framus acoustic guitar. And that was something that a group like the Kingston Trio would use, you know, 12-string acoustic. So here was John moving more into folk music with that. He used it on a couple of songs. They had new guitars. I mentioned the Epiphone Casinos, but also Stratocasters. John and George got Fender Stratocasters. And for keyboards, they got, Hohner Pianette, which is an electric piano-type sound. And they also used a Vox Continental organ. So they were using new instruments on this album that gave it new songs. And rather than George Martin being the one overdubbing the keyboards, Paul and John were overdubbing the keyboards, or George Martin playing live with them on the earlier albums. So they really were expanding their musical horizons.
Well, also the plot of the film has something to do with Indian cult or something like that?
It's kind of like, we had Westerns in the U.S., but we also had Easterns. Uh-huh. And Easterns were kind of, the mysterious East.
Yeah.
And it was based on that. And what was interesting, though, is on the music for it, George Martin was a musical director for A Hard Day's Night, but he and Dick Lester did not get along. And Dick Lester basically didn't want to use him. He brought in Ken Thorne, who he had used for one of his earlier films, It's Trad Dad, to do the incidental music, the background music. George Martin still produced and recorded the Beatles songs. So the idea was that this music would be some Ken Thorne originals, it would be some classical music, it would be James Bond-influenced music, and it also would have an Eastern feel to it. And often you would hear in it Beatles songs, but done with Indian instruments. One track called Another Hard Day's Night, and it was played on Indian instruments. And that's what's talk about real quickly. Capitol Records did a soundtrack album. In other words, Capitol, rather than doing, hey, here's an album of 11 new Beatles songs or 14 new Beatles songs like in the UK, they had the 7 Beatles songs recorded by the Beatles from the film, plus recordings from the film, exclusive instrumental selections from the film, as they dubbed it. They made it a gatefold album so they could charge an extra dollar. And a lot of people looking back on it tell me they really liked those instrumental selections. Some of them said they enjoyed it because they would visualize the film when they heard it. The album even opens out with a variation of the James Bond film, uncredited, leading directly into the single Help. So it's quite an interesting album. And one of the weird things is the last track on the album is an Indian raga, which doesn't sound that different from what George would be doing on Revolver.
Well, I was about to say, that's why I brought this up, because I wanted to say that's how George kind of got interested in Indian
Absolutely.
Music.
You know, and you wonder, as much as I love George Martin and his, music and all, I don't know whether George Martin's soundtrack would have, involved the instruments to that degree, and George might not have come across the sitar at that time. And when you get to the album After Help and Rubber Soul, there's George playing sitar on the song Norwegian Wood. And by Revolver, a song like Love You Too is truly an Indian music song through and through. Nothing, normal about it,
Well, in your presentation, you've already spoken about the link to James Bond, but of course James Bond was very popular at that time, as with the Beatles, and they're both English, icons.
Yes, absolutely.
So can you expand a little bit on that, maybe, about the things in the film that were touched on James Bond?
Yeah. One of the things in the James Bond movies, they have Q Branch, which comes off with these exotic, things that, you've got a pen that, shoots a dart out, and things like that. And so in Help, you show one where, as a parking meter, where someone puts a nickel in the parking meter and gas comes out at them. Well, in Help, you've got one where Klang, the bad guy in Help, he's sitting on, on the ground in the Alps waiting for the Beatles to come by, and he has an umbrella that's actually a flamethrower. Q Branch would have been very proud of that.
Yeah.
One of the more humorous ones is you have Oddjob, who's the henchman for Goldfinger, and Goldfinger has him show James Bond his derby, and and Oddjob throws his derby, and it knocks the head off a statue. It has a steel blade in it. Mm-hmm. So in Help, there's a scene where one of the henchmen for Klang takes off his turban hat, and he goes to throw it, and he makes the same sound effect, the whoosh sound that you hear from the derby, except, of course, it's cloth, and it just, hits the floor,
yeah.
And he takes a frying pan and knocks a guy out with, over the head with the frying pan.
Yeah.
That's one of the more humorous ones. The other one, James Bond's Austin Martin DB5. The car has defense mechanisms in it, and one of the ones shown in Goldfinger is it lets an oil slick out, and the cars with Goldfinger's men are following, James Bond in, hit the oil slick, and one of them goes off the road and goes down an embankment and explodes. In Help, Klang commandeers a Harrods truck, and when he hits the button on the thing, it releases some carpet tacks onto the street. And finally, there's a laser scene where a laser is going and aimed at James Bond, who's strapped to a table, and it's cutting through gold, heading right towards James Bond at a very strategic place to literally cut him in two. And James Bond fortunately talks Goldfinger out of doing that. And in Help, there's a scene where the mad scientist and his assistant have a laser that's cutting through the floor aimed at the Beatles, and it blows a fuse.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's, you know, those are the four classic cases of, you know, where parodies and you know, look for them in the film, and it's just very cool.
Yeah, it is. It is. I found it so when I saw your presentation. Also, in that presentation, you actually showed a clip from a James Bond film where James Bond actually mentions the Beatles.
Yes, he does.
Sean Connery does.
Sean Connery is talking about he's with this woman in bed, big shock, and he notices that the champagne has lost its chill, and he says he's going to get another bottle. And the woman he's with says, "Who needs it?" And he says, "My dear, there's some things that just aren't done, you know, like drinking Dom Perignon champagne before the temperature of, you know, what is 38 degrees Fahrenheit." And says, "That's as bad as listening to the Beatles without earmuffs." That's it's a great line, but let me tell you, right after he says that line, Odd Job knocks him out. So got to be careful when you knock the Beatles.
But did he get any hate mail?
I don't think he got any hate mail from it. I think getting knocked out by Odd Job was enough.
Okay, all right. Well, we've got about 10 more minutes to go here on Chewing the Yacht with Bruce Spizer. I appreciate you taking the time to do this, Bruce. One thing I'd like to ask you, it's a little bit of a deviation from the book, perhaps, but you talked about, you know, the George Harrison having the first two songs on the album.
Yeah.
And he didn't have any before. And we talked about the sitar. I mean, I'm sure you may talk about this in some of the books, I don't know, but was there a lot of friction between the three of them? In other words, since he didn't get to put his songs on the albums?
Initially, there wasn't, because George wasn't writing songs for the most part. But as George began to write songs, it began to be a problem. He did get three songs on Revolver. Sergeant Pepper, he had one track only. You know, but then later on the White Album, he had four tracks. But, you know, they go into the studio, and when they're doing the Let It Be Get Back sessions, by then, George has well over a dozen really good songs, and he knows he's not going to get 12 of them on the album.
Sure.
And so it was a bit of a problem. And I think if the Beatles had stayed together, John had talked about the idea that, you know, they would do albums, and the way the albums would be done would be that he would have four songs, Paul would have four songs, and George would have four songs, and Ringo would get two songs.
Okay.
And, you know, John recognized it was a problem. And, you know, I think Paul realized it as well. But I think John in particular was not as enthusiastic on George's songs as he was on his own songs or on Paul's songs, to a certain extent. I mean, there were exceptions like Obladi Oblada that John absolutely hated and was sick of doing three different versions of it. By the time they went in to do, you know, what Paul was, this is going to be the way to do it, John was on piano, and he knocks out these chords in a very angry manner. And, of course, we don't hear them as angry. We hear them as, you know, these powerful piano notes.
Yeah,
so, you know, yeah, so George really did, you know, emerge, you know, tremendously with Help. The videos in Help, when you see, you know, see them performing, they're just wonderful videos. I can't emphasize enough how spectacular these were. The British press, when they had a screening on a morning of the film, after the Hard Day's Night video, there was like a standing ovation for that song by the press. Now, some of these same people knocked the movie overall, but they recognized it. Reviews were mixed in the UK, a little bit better in the US. And I think some of the reviewers said it best. So one woman, she talked about all the problems with the film and said, you know, but I laughed and enjoyed it. You know, don't try to analyze it. Don't try to this. Just go to it and enjoy it. It's
right.
A fantasy film.
Yeah.
Because that's what it was. It was a fantasy film. It wasn't Citizen Kane.
Well, I mean, I think that all in all, I mean, the Beatles, they only made these two films like this. I mean, they did the Yellow Submarine and Let It Be.
But the Magical Mystery Tour. Magical but only Mystery two Tour. Major theatrical releases.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they came out on the plus side as related to, say, Elvis's movies. I mean, although some of Elvis' movies are okay, but they, you know.
Yeah, you know, Jailhouse Rock, certainly the one filmed in New Orleans, would be
Kid Creole.
Kid Creole would be my favorite Elvis movie. That was terrific. But for the most part, Elvis was just banging out these movies. The Beatles did not want to do that.
Right.
They were never ones to just, let's do what everyone else is doing by putting out an album, you know, with one or two good songs and the rest is filler. When you listen to a Beatles album, you can play that album all the way through. You don't feel the need to get up and lift the needle if you're playing a record.
Right. Well, listen, again, we're here with Bruce Spizer, one of the experts on the Beatles in the world, top experts, here, and a native New Orleanian, went to Newman,
Okay. Yeah, I went to Newman for 13 years, and, you know, I like telling people that was just high school.
Oh, there you go. See, well, it served you well.
Yeah.
Okay.
It did. After that, I went to Tulane.
Yeah.
And I have 3 degrees from Tulane.
They
I have
let you out the city or what?
Well, no, you know, I mean, I love New Orleans.
An ankle bracelet or what?
Something like that, yeah, yeah. You know, a little ankle bracelet holding me here.
Yeah.
But I have a BA in economics, a master's in business administration, concentrating in finance and marketing, and then a law degree.
Okay.
And I'm still practicing law. Yeah. I do estate planning and a little bit of tax and corporate work.
Okay, well, that's
successions.
That's good to know as well. If I ever get any money, I might call you. But we've got about 6 minutes to go here. Is there anything that we haven't talked about in The Beatles for Sale to Help, which is Bruce's new title?
I think, you know, I once again, you know, want to thank on all the Beatles album series. It's a series of 9 books, and it covers, you know, all of the UK Beatle albums and all of the U.S. iterations of them. And the Canadian albums, which are different from the earlier ones. And on the people that helped me with the chapters, it was a real pleasure. I would get really well-written pieces. And, of course, I'd edit them for the book and maybe move things around to make sure the text and the images went out well. But I think that, you know, those alone are worth the price of admission. If you didn't like the Beatles, you learn about, you know, what was going on in the world at that time. There are a lot of magazine covers from Life, Time, and Newsweek. And, you know, you get a good feel for what was going on. And in editing these, sometimes you just come across really, you know, fun coincidences. And one of the things, and I'm sure I was the only person to ever make this connection, and, you know, the information's there, but someone has to make the connection. And that was that when the Beatles flew to America for the first time, they flew Pan Am Boeing 707, and Pan Am named their planes. And they arrived on Clipper Defiance. What a wonderful name for that. They defied the U.S. press, the tough New York press, and the press loved them. You know, they just couldn't believe how entertaining they were. And when I was editing the piece on, you know, what was going on in the world at the time, one of the things that was going on was the evacuation of non-essential personnel from the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. And the article in Newsweek talked about how they were rushed to the airport, and they were running up the stairway to Pan Am Clipper Defiance.
Uh-huh.
And the date of that was February 7, 1965, exactly 1 year after that exact same physical airplane had brought the Beatles to the U.S. for the first time. That same plane evacuated non-essential embassy personnel from South Vietnam, taking them from South Vietnam to Hawaii.
That's
one of those little weird things that's out there.
Well, it's very interesting, and I will say this. Okay, the Beatles have legs, because I've been to a couple of your recent books events that you've had, like the one at the Britannia Theater, which was, you know, sold out, basically. And there were a lot of children there, because I guess maybe Grandpa and Mama brought them. But nonetheless, they were there.
I think
they enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I went to the one in Jefferson Parish Library, and you were giving the presentation, which was wonderful, by the way.
Thank you.
But you could tell the enthusiasm. Now, all the people were like of an older ilk at that, with most of them, but you could tell the enthusiasm they still have for this by how they reacted to the songs.
Yeah.
Physically, actually.
Yeah.
Actually.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the good things about these books is it does show you that, I mean, they're obviously a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're a historical phenomenon regardless. And they were, and they are. And it's nice to look back at those things. Now, if you're a Beatles fan listening, you might not like this last question, but I just thought about it, and I want to ask you.
No, I'm kidding.
Is this correct or not? The Help, the album or the film, I can't remember which, was dedicated to somebody. It was dedicated to Elias Howe.
Yes.
Howe, the person who invented the sewing machine.
Yes, that was put at the end of Help. Just why not?
Okay, just for grins and
giggles. Just something, yes. It was during that particular
kind of a Monty Python sort of.
Yeah,
thing.
You know, the film ends and opens, you know, for not the second opening, you know, but when it starts, you know, you have this mysterious East Temple and a ritual going on, and then the Beatles go in to Help. And at the end of the film, the song Help is played. And then after that, when the credits roll, you know, right after you have the dedication to the sewing machine inventor, you have the Beatles doing kind of a strange version of the Barbara Seville.
Oh, yeah.
You know, da, 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 da. And, you know, and you hear George going, you know, I Need You by George Harrison, and gets that in, you know, because that was featured in the film. And that's recorded, shot on Salisbury Plain. And there's a wonderful scene where it's a close-up of George and his guitar, sharp focus, and then it goes soft focus on that and focuses in the background, sharp focus on Stonehenge. And for those of you that are Spinal Tap fans, that is a Beatles connection, because Stonehenge is in that Beatles film Help.
And we're almost out of time, but the song Help, in other words, the album, the movie actually had a lot of titles before it got Help. Mm-hmm. And it came from a song that John just wrote like in one day. Or
yeah, what
like
happened is, same with The Hard Day's Night. This film originally was going to be called Eight Arms to Hold You, and John said, thank God we got another title. That'd be kind of hard to write a song called that.
Yeah.
And so John quickly worked, you know, primarily John's song with some help from Paul. He had a basic musical idea already there, and they put it together quickly. They did the same thing for A Hard Day's Night.
Okay, well, we're out of time, unfortunately. Thank you, Bruce Spicer, for taking all this time to share with your thoughts about the Beatles.
And work. Beatle.net.
Beatle.net, that's right. Don't forget that. I can't recommend these books more, all of them. Thank you. Thank you so much, Bruce. This is Chris Champagne listening to Chewing the Yacht, WAMF 90.3 FM. We're on every Wednesday, they tell me, at 5 p.m. Thank you, Bruce.
You're welcome.
Okay, great.